Good morning, beloved. It's so good to be with you this morning. If you would like to turn in your copy of Scripture to Ecclesiastes chapter 6, we will be there momentarily. Ecclesiastes chapter 6 will also be on the screen in a few moments, but I'd like to begin with a eulogy. This is a eulogy for this watch. I love this watch. This watch marked the time of its own death, as watches tend to do, at 6:08 a.m. yesterday. But this watch actually outlived its life expectancy. I thought it met its demise about 2 weeks ago. But there were two high points in the life of this watch that just really stood out to me that I'd like to share with you in commemoration of this watch's life. This watch was once on my wrist when a good friend of mine who has a degree in fine arts, and I consider him a great artist, he looked at said watch and said, "I like that watch." And I don't know why you're laughing. I said, "I love its simplicity." And I said, "Me too. I'm a minimalist. I like simplicity. And so I love, like, there are no numbers, just little marks. It's nice and simple and clean. Much as I like the majority of my life to be simple. In fact, when I am in a place of pain, when things are not going well, when I am tired, deprived, or whatever it is, some of you therapists would rightly say your OCD comes out, but I start to simplify everything. And I just greatly enjoy in those moments of stress to escape to throwing things away and decluttering and cleaning and just cutting things out. So that was one highlight of this watch's life. The other one was when a guy who has fought in MMA and has lived, he trains in martial arts, and he looked at said watch on my wrist, and he looked at me, and he said, "I like that tactical watch." I said, "Me too." It's not a tactical watch, but I like what you're saying. Because also, in moments of pain, I also tend to like to just get things done. I feel better when I can accomplish something. And so I'll often escape to just getting things done. And so highlights of this watch that make me think about moments of pain. Because when we're in pain, we often have forms of escape that we run to. We don't like to sit in the pain. We don't like to sit in the struggle, the tension, the strife. We want to escape to something, and that's called escapism. Escapism, if you would like a formal definition, escapism, I can't speak today. It's been a couple weeks. I'm going to get back into this with you. It's the habitual diversion of the mind to purely imaginative activity or entertainment as an escape from reality or routine. So what's your escape? What is it that you run to when you feel deprived, when you feel stressed, when you feel hurt, when you feel that pain, whatever it is? What do you run to as an escape? Perhaps it's binge watching some streaming service. Perhaps it's scrolling through websites, looking at things you know you should not be looking at. Perhaps it's drinking a little too much or a lot too much. Perhaps it's overindulging in that food. Whatever it is, what is your escape? It might just be a fantasy in your head that you just check out of reality and you go to that place in your mind. But where do you run to escape? This watch is dead now. And the problem is that this watch is supposed to be waterproof for 10 atmospheres. And if you're a diver, that's a long way down. I'm not going that far down, whether I'm tanked up or not. But I swam down a couple weeks ago on vacation to all of maybe 7 or 8 feet of water. And the pressure, somehow, with this waterproof watch, made it a water-filled watch. And if you could see a little closer, you can see still the bubbles and so forth in there. And what's amazing, I told you, it lived until yesterday morning. I couldn't see it very well, but it lived until yesterday morning. It still kept telling the time until it finally met its demise. But here's the thing about that watch. Pressure, the pressure going underwater, the pressure is what brought the water in. But then, as you can see, if you can see, it couldn't get out. And such is the way of escapism, that the pressure will drive us to these things we run to. And we throw ourselves into that, hoping that that will give us some sense of semblance of peace and comfort, entertainment, whatever it is. We are pressured into that, but then it's like we can't get out of that, and we just go to it more and more and more. And it's like this silly watch. The pressure brings it in, but then we can't get it out. It's the way of escapism, and the escapes that we run to often become hard to escape, and they prove to be no escape at all. And so we have to be honest about that as we come to the text today. I want you to identify, what are your escapes? What do you run to try to escape? So Ecclesiastes chapter 6, the teacher continues on. And so recall, this is part of the wisdom literature. And so wisdom literature, broadly speaking, is trying to help us to navigate life on a broken planet. What are the ways in which we should navigate this world that is marred by sin, by death, brokenness, because of our sin that's brought all this about? How do we navigate this life in wisdom? And so he is being incredibly brutally honest with us, as you have seen, as we're making our way through. And so chapter 6 is very much going to start with kind of reviewing what Derek brought us through, our Kampala missions partner, last week. So let's start in verse 1. Here is a tragedy I have observed under the sun, and it weighs heavily on humanity. God gives a person riches, wealth, and honor so that he lacks nothing of all he desires for himself, but God does not allow him to enjoy them. Instead, a stranger will enjoy them. This is futile and a sickening tragedy. A man may father 100 children and live many years. No matter how long he lives, if he is not satisfied by good things and does not have a proper burial, I say that a stillborn child is better off than he. For he comes in futility, and he goes in darkness, and his name is shrouded in darkness. Though a stillborn child does not see the sun and is not conscious, it has more rest than he. And if a person lives 1,000 years twice but does not experience happiness, do not both go to the same place? All of a person's labor is for his stomach, yet the appetite is never satisfied. You hear him kind of repeating that poetic refrain of the cycle from chapter 1. Verse 8, what advantage then does the wise person have over the fool? What advantage is there for the poor person who knows how to conduct himself before others? Better what the eyes see than wandering desire. This too is futile and a pursuit of the wind. And so he starts this chapter, he brings us through, and is basically, again, making this extensive argument, if you have not caught on. So again, whether this is actually Solomon or writing under the literary guise of Solomon, we're to think of this person as someone who had the means to do whatever he wanted. Wealth amassed that has been incomparable to any other king, and he is just amazingly smart. He's accomplishing so many things. He's innovative. He has all the pleasures he wants. He just does what he wants. And he looks at all of it with his wisdom and he says, it's all futile. What is this? Chasing after the wind. It just vanishes. It's nothing. And we're asking the question that he posed in the first chapter in verse 3. What good does it bring about? All of our effort, everything we're striving for under the sun, is there any meaning to it? Or is it all just futile? This is all of our effort. And now he says again, wealth, how much of our lives is in this rat race of trying to acquire, accumulate more and more wealth to do whatever thing we want to do with it? And maybe it's just to hoard it. And he says, wealth, you know what? It's just not going to cut it. It will not satisfy. He goes through it again, and he gives the example, like, even if you acquire great, great amounts of wealth, and then another can just consume it before it can be enjoyed. Extensively, the teacher is pointing to the apparent futility in all of our efforts under the sun. And we know, we can jump to the conclusion, why is that? It's futile. It's absolutely, it really truly is futile unless it is for the Lord and with the Lord. So everything that we can do under the sun, meaningless, futile. It goes nowhere. But if we are tethered to the Lord and his power, what he can do, that's where we find meaning. But he is going to continue. It's like nauseating at this point that he's just so brutally honest, turning over every stone, saying, let's look hard at these hard questions. Be honest about them. It brings him to these hard questions that even comes to the point of him saying, like, but is life even worth it? Would it be better to just be stillborn, to have never seen the sun, than to come live under the sun and all of your labor and toil under the sun to be futile? Real questions. Look at verse 9 again. Better what the eyes see than wandering desire. This too is futile and a pursuit of the wind. So if all of this is true, that it's just better to have not been born, but better what the eyes see than wandering desire. What does futility drive us to? Escapism. Do you see it there? Better what the eyes actually see. Better reality, what you're actually living, where you are, than wandering desire or the way that you check out and you chase after things to escape from reality. And he says, no, 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 better what's actually here. This escapism thing, oh, this too is futile. A chasing after the wind. Futility drives us to escapism. And escapism then ironically can drive us to futility, and it becomes yet another of these cycles he's talking about. Never satisfied, never filled. We just go and go and go, and yet we're stuck in it so often. Futility drives us to escapism. Escapism ironically driving us to futility. And I love the way that the French novelist and journalist Georges Bernanos, he says this. He says, it will not be cruelty that will be responsible for our extinction, and still less, of course, the indignation that cruelty awakens and the reprisals and vengeance that it brings on itself, but the docility, the lack of responsibility of the modern man, his base subservience, acceptance of every common decree. The horrors that we have seen, the still greater horrors that we shall presently see, are not signs that rebels, insubordinate, untamable men are increasing in number throughout the world, but rather that there is a constant increase in the number of obedient, docile men. Escapism leads us to futility. Futility leads us to escapism. And what do these things bring us to? A life worth nothing. A bunch of docile men afraid to take on the challenges of this life. That we run to these escapes to escape from the things that are hurting us instead of looking at them and acting like men. And the call here is to say, no, act like a man. Paul said that to the church in Corinth, act like men. That we don't run from our problems. Face them. What is the escape that we run to? And we have to see, as he says, better what the eyes see than wandering desire. This too is futile and a pursuit of the wind. Better to face it. He goes on, verse 10. Whatever exists was given its name long ago, and it is known what mankind is. But he is not able to contend with the one stronger than he. Do you hear it? Almost like he's anticipating the response. Oh, you want us to stop running from what we're running from? You want to act like a man and all that? Well, I'll show you strength. Whatever exists was given its name long ago, and it is known what mankind is. He knows what we are. But he, man, is not able to contend with the one stronger than he. For when there are many words, they increase futility. All the excuses we could give, what's it going to do? It just increases futility. What is the advantage for mankind? For who knows what is good for anyone in life and the few days of his futile life that he spends like a shadow? Who can tell anyone what will happen after him under the sun? These questions point to the reality of our limitations. We often run from things because we have limitations, and we should be honest about that. But he's saying, limitations are real. Escapism says you just try to avoid and ignore your limitations. Those real limitations, the kind that we try to avoid and escape. And then real questions, the kind that we try to avoid and escape. And he throws them out there, honestly, to say, let's discuss them. And so look at the wisdom he shares in response to bringing this up as we continue in verse 1 of chapter 7. He says, a good name is better than fine perfume. And the day of one's death is better than the day of one's birth. These are the limitations revealed by death. As we go through these next few verses, you'll notice that they're kind of bracketed more like poetry, that he's giving us now these limitations. And we need to be honest about the limitations we have and how we try to escape them, but let's look at them. Let's look them in the eye and see them for what they are and see the futility in them. So he starts, a good name is better than fine perfume. You know that idea, right? Fine perfume. We all love a pleasant smell. Unpleasant smell? Not so much. And you know the physical reaction you have to a bad smell? You walk in the room, it's like, oh, oh, oh. And like, that affected your nose and went to your brain, but something about the whole body recoils, like, oh. And he's saying, better a good name than fine perfume. Because a bad name can have the same type of effect. You probably know somebody, and you probably hope that you are not that name. That when that name is spoken in certain audiences, there's like a physical reaction. Oh, ugh. Kind of recoil, like a bad odor hitting you. Better a good name. Good smell, good name. Bad smell, bad name. Those physical reactions, we know what that's like. And then he continues. What was it? the day of one's death is better than the day of one's birth. Happy Father's Day. What does that mean? Is that hyperbole? Is he exaggerating something to make a point? Is a death day better than a birthday? I remember when my kids were born. When my son was born, my firstborn, it was pretty scary. He went to the NICU for a few days, and when they took him out, it was wild. I watched that doctor flip him around and do all kinds of stuff to get things out of his lungs. It was crazy. And yet, at the same time, it was so happy. You get through that moment, like, he's alive, like, what a miracle. This is amazing. You're walking around. There's a whole hospital devoted to this. And everyone I see is like, yeah, like celebrating. You see my child and all this stuff. Like, birthing floors tend to be really happy places until they're not. But by and large, the birthday is a happy day. And so what is he saying when he says day of one's death better than the day of one's birth? How is that possible? It's not saying that there is no happiness in birth. He's saying, what will instruct us more? What will be the better tutor? What will be the better instruction? The birthday or the death day? And we all immediately know the answer. Because the birthday, so full of hope, so full of excitement and joy. But would those parents be just as excited and just as happy if they knew that the life that that kid will actually live is going to be full of sorrow and hurt? No. And it's not wrong to be excited, and I hope you do. Like, we just had another baby born in the church this week. Like, I love babies. It's so exciting. Keep having them. You're making children's ministry even bigger. It's great. But here's the thing. The day of birth is full of potential, as one commentator said. The day of death is about fulfillment. Do you see the difference? Day of birth, all the laughter and everything, all the hopes and dreams of potential, the potential for this child, and that's so exciting. The day of death, but here's the reality of a life lived. Here's the fulfillment of what actually occurred. And he says, which one is actually going to teach you? You want wisdom? You want to live within the real limitations that we have on us? Consider the day of death. We talked about this before multiple times, but it's that idea of David Brooks, the resume or eulogy skills. Which will teach us more? So we keep reading verse 2. It is better to go to a house of mourning than to go to a house of feasting, since that is the end of all mankind, and the living should take it to heart. Grief is better than laughter, for when a face is sad, a heart may be glad. The heart of the wise is in the house of mourning, but the heart of fools is in a house of pleasure. It is better to listen to rebuke from a wise person than to listen to the song of fools, for like the crackling of burning thorns under the pot, so is the laughter of the fool. This too is futile. So 2 days before I go on vacation, I get invited to the hospital, and as a pastor, I do that rather frequently, and it's actually something that while I hurt with people who are hurting, I enjoy the privilege, the honor of being invited into what I think are sacred spaces. So there's a mother who is dying, late stages of cancer, and she ended up actually passing away about 4 or 5 days later. I'm invited into the room. I walk into the room, spend some time with her, and as I'm about to leave, the child of this mother who is my age looks at me and says, we actually know a family friend across the hall. And we're not really sure where she is spiritually, but we've known her for a long time, and she's dying as well. Could you go talk to her? I walk in the room, and it's quiet. We have gone past the point of monitoring all the vitals. We know what's happening here. And she's in pain, but they're giving her pain medication and so forth. And as she sits on the bed, and the predominant noise in the room is her shuffling, as she moves her body back and forth, just trying to find some kind of relief and comfort. Sheets on, sheets off, blanket up, blanket off. And just turning this way and that way. As we start to talk, often in hospitals, people want to avoid eye contact. There's just a great discomfort with what's going on. But the person who's dying will often look me straight in the eyes. And this lady locks eyes with me. And the first thing out of her mouth, she says, Pastor, what happens after I die? What happens after I die? my response? With all the pain and the fear and knowing everything that she's going through right now as best I can, I have to honestly say judgment. Judgment. Questions that we could spend our entire lives avoiding, escaping, suddenly are hard to avoid when we are looking at death in the face. Let death be a teacher. Fools escape the instruction of death by running to the house of pleasure, running to laughter as opposed to the lesson learned by a wise rebuke in the face of honest assessment. You see it in the text. Will we run from that, or will we accept that? Will we look at it? And this is not to be just kind of sadistic or masochistic or just like, oh, we're such fatalists, like look at death all the time, but to say, no, you want to live wisely. Consider the end. Consider the end and let today be lived in light of that day that is coming, because better the day of mourning than the day of birth. It is a better teacher. And the irony is that in the honest look at death, that is where we are helped to truly enjoy the good in this life. But so often, we just try to enjoy things and avoid that, and thereby we don't actually enjoy the gift that life really is. Let's not run from it. He continues in verse 7. And now we turn to the limitations of wisdom. We see the limitations of death, that your life will have an end. And now he turns to the limitations of wisdom itself. He says, surely the practice of extortion turns a wise person into a fool, and a bribe corrupts the mind. This is about extortion and money. And money can so easily turn the wise into fools. Have you seen that in your own life? Personally or anecdotally, your observations of others, that the offer of money can take someone who is incredibly wise and upstanding and suddenly make them just foolish. You heard the phrase, everyone has a price. Everything's for sale, it's just if the price is right. Everyone has a price, and here's the calling of wisdom, prove that wrong. There is no price on you. If you want to put a price on your life, know that it was the cost of the life of the Son of God. You have been bought with a price, therefore honor the Lord with your body. But money, extortion, bribes can make wise people foolish. And verse 8, the end of the matter is better than its beginning. A patient spirit is better than a proud spirit. It's about patience. The limitations of wisdom, that patience can be the limiting factor, can be the ceiling on how we operate in wisdom. It's become pretty cliche, pretty niche actually, to look at what kind of a person you are, what aligns with your personality. Are you a starter or are you a finisher? And while I would say there's absolutely some wisdom to knowing your strengths, sometimes we look at that and we use that as an excuse to not just simply have endurance and patience. See it through. But we live in what some are calling the microwave society. Everything's got to be fast. The Andy Crouch, the magic buttons, that we click things and instantaneously things happen. This is why our kids get so frustrated. You give them a tablet and they can figure it out faster than we can, and they're just loving it and everything, and then you take it away, and what do? They lose their minds. And you're like, who is this creature? You're not my child. What are you so full of wrath for? And like, you gave them a magic button, you took it away. How would you feel? Here's this superpower that goes contrary to everything that is natural about what's in you, that we should work for things. Make it immediate without effort, and then take that away. And what does it do to us? It points to our impatience. The limitation on wisdom, your bracket for patience. Verse 9, don't let your spirit rush to be angry, for anger abides in the hearts of fools. I would ask, what are you in a rush for? This is deeply convicting to me. I get angry so fast. Why? Why is anger the thing that comes out quickly? And we must see how quickly it makes us fools. If anger comes out quickly, we are quickly becoming fools. And then verse 10, don't say, why were the former days better than these? Since it is not wise of you to ask this. What is this about? I am 30, yeah, that was embarrassing. I'm late 30s, I think I'm 37, going on 38. Does that tell you anything? I know that I am younger than many of you in this room, and I know that I'm older than many of you in this room. But here's what I have already learned. It is so easy for me to look back to 20 years ago in high school and think, those were the days. And I say that a lot. Like, man, I tell my kids all the time, if I would have done that when I was your age and all these things, and somehow this is what we do, this nostalgia, that our childhood we romanticize. We create it into these beautiful things, and we look at this current generation, the generation to come, we're like, whoa, wow, things have gotten bad. And what are we doing in that? Maybe some of our observations are truly accurate. But what we're doing when we decry these things is we're actually questioning whether God and his current presence, his current provision, his current power, and his current gifts for you are actually enough. So we better be careful with that. When we decry today and delight in yesterday. C.S. Lewis talked a lot about this, actually, and he made the point that often what's happening is the nostalgia, these feelings in us are betraying us because what we have done is we've become convinced that it was in these things in the past that we found beauty, when really it was through these things in the past that we found beauty. And so we change what we're looking for to no longer see beauty through things because the giver of the gift is far more beautiful than the gift. And instead, we start looking into things for the beauty. And then we're let down, and it becomes futile. So where are you looking for beauty and fulfillment? The nostalgia of the past should actually, in an honest way, point us to the reality that what we yearn for is far beyond what we can find here on this earth. At it, the eyes never satisfied with seeing, the ears never filled with hearing. The streams running to the ocean, yet the ocean never being filled. The stomach, we eat continually for its appetite, and yet again and again, we're dissatisfied. So we keep going, verse 11. Wisdom is as good as an inheritance, an advantage to those who see the sun, because wisdom is protection, as silver is protection. But the advantage of knowledge is that wisdom preserves the life of its owner. Consider the work of God, for who can straighten out what he has made crooked? In the day of prosperity, be joyful. But in the day of adversity, consider God has made the one as well as the other, so that no one can discover anything that will come after him. Wisdom is truly beneficial, but it has its limits because we are not God who is limitless. And here's the thing, can you accept that? Can you accept that you have limits? Can you accept your limitations, or will we continue to run to our escapes? Because those are kind of our options here. Accept that we have limitations, or just escapism. Check out. Ignore them. Avoid them. Living wisely is living in the limits of wisdom. Gibson is a commentator, and he wrote this. When summarizing each of these like seemingly random things as we read through those 13 verses of chapter 7, and they seem like they're all over the place, like why is he just running through these things? He ties them together and says they're actually far more connected than we think. This is what he says. Extortion is a way of escaping your responsibility. Impatience is a way of escaping reality and wishing things were different from the way they are. Anger is a way of escaping your inability to cope with things not being the way you want them. Nostalgia is a form of escapism by taking a vacation in the past instead of grappling with the present and looking to the future in faith. They're all pointing us to this tendency we have to just try to escape. Accept your limitations instead of trying to escape them. A limitation that we all share, our inability to save ourselves, our inability to make ourselves right, our inability to escape death, that over and over he's saying, it's coming. You need to be honest about that, and that's how you will live today rightly. But when you just avoid that, you ignore that, you will live foolishly today. See the limitations of death. And then as you seek wisdom in that, that it's wise to see the limitations of death, you need to see there are also other limitations of wisdom. Now today we get sidetracked by so many things. We run to so many things to try to escape this reality. Saying, no, if you would accept these limitations instead of escaping them, there we might find meaning, purpose, the opposite of futility. And all of us needing saving, because we are all sinners, we all must look to the one who did not sin, a God who is unlimited, who stepped in to become a man like us who are limited. the gospel, the good news of Jesus Christ. This is the way that Paul wrote it to the Roman church in Romans chapter 5, verse 15. For if by the one man's trespass the many died, how much more have the grace of God and the gift which comes through the grace of the one man, Jesus Christ, overflowed to the many? All of us, through one man, come to death, through the sin of Adam, and all of us participating in that great rebellion with him. We are all sinners. And yet, by the one man, Jesus, sinless, we can be made righteous. We must look to him. I'm in the hospital room with a dying woman and says, Pastor, what happens when I die? And I look at her, and I have to be honest, because we look to the conclusion of this book, asking hard questions. And he says, when all has been heard, the conclusion of the matter is this: fear God and keep his commands, because this is for all humanity. For God will bring every act to judgment, including every hidden thing, whether good or evil. We will face judgment. And I have to answer her honestly and tell her, judgment is what you can expect. There is a God, and you will stand before him in judgment. But then I get to have this big smile as I tell her, but I have good news for you. That even now, moments before you die and you stand before God, you can know that that God is good. And he created everything good. Every bit of it, he created good. He declared it to be good. He made us in his own image to tell the world what he's like, to take cultural mandates forward, to say this is art and this is beauty and we can take dominion of this world. He made us to be in this grand adventure to rule and reign with him over this planet. But we are guilty because we defied him, we shook our fists at him and said, I'll be my own God. I'll eat from the tree of knowledge of good and evil. Instead of trusting you, I'll trust myself. And pride led us to this great fall. And now there's this separation because God is holy and we have defied him and there is due wrath for us, that we are guilty, we are sinners, and we deserve condemnation. But listen, lady, he is gracious, he is so good, and he loves us that in spite of us, in spite of our treachery, he loves us so much that he made a way for us to be brought back with him, to be in the relationship that we were created to be in with him, to enjoy his love and his favor, to enjoy the fact that he delights in us and we get to delight in him, and he's the only one who will ever satisfy you. And there is nothing you could ever do in this life that you are now coming to a close on that could ever earn that grace, that favor. He gives it to you in love. And he made a way through his son. His name is Jesus. He lived a sinless life. You've messed up. I've messed up. We can be honest about that and know it's true that we deserve death. We have sinned, but Jesus never did. He did not deserve death. And yet he took all of our sin, all of the due punishment for us on himself. And he died the death that you and I deserve on a cross. And he did that to forgive us, to make us free, forgiven, to be alive with him forevermore because he died. But he didn't stay dead. He rose again on the third day, and he's alive right now. And he holds the keys of death and Hades. That means you will not die until he unlocks that door and says, come through here. And he can be trusted. And so I invited her, would you trust him? Would you believe this good news that God loves you so much, he made a way for you to be forgiven? So when you stand in judgment before him, he says, well done, good and faithful servant. You can't leave this bed, but like the thief on the cross, who changed his mind at some point while they sat there dying slowly, and he called Jesus Lord and said, remember me when you enter into your kingdom. And Jesus, with grace, says, today you'll be with me in paradise. And that man could not get off the cross and do anything different, but he could confess the lordship of Jesus and begin to delight in him. Oh, there's nothing you could do to save yourself, but trust God that he can save you. So will you believe him? Will you put your faith in him, trusting he loves you and he died for you and he rose again, and confess him to be your Lord? Turn from your sin. With what time you have, seek the Lord. This is the invitation to a dying woman 2 weeks ago, and this is the invitation to you, because you must look at death. It is a great tutor. This is how life will actually matter, to consider the end, to consider that day is coming, the day of judgment. And we come back to this, a good God our guilt, his grace, a life now, however long, lived in gratitude, knowing that glory is coming for us. And all glory be to God. It's good news. Can you believe it? And will you share it with another neighbor? It's worth sharing. It's worth giving our life to. Accept your limitations. Instead of trying to escape them, you must find refuge in God. And as we close, I want to give you a few moments now to actually practice this. Because it is so easy for us to give mental assent. So I know that's true, but to do nothing actually about it. The draw of escapism is really strong, particularly when we ignore or deny that we are actually experiential beings as humans. God made you and me to actually feel things. The same way that these things we feel throw us into escapism, we run to these forms of escape. God made us to feel things. And we should be honest about that and not just try to avoid them. And I'm really good at that. Let me be honest. But we should be honest with them. We have thoughts and we have feelings. The Psalms are so good for my soul because they teach me how to be honest about my emotions and how to run to God with them. When I am overwhelmed, when I am crippled, when I am experiencing anything that I want to withdraw and I want to run to my forms of escape, whether that's the doom scrolling or the clean it all out, let's just knock everything off the task list, whatever it is. Instead, there's an invitation from Jesus to just come to him. My favorite verses, my kids memorized this with us recently, is Psalm 46:1. Says, God is our refuge and strength, a helper who is always found in times of trouble. You want an escape because you want a refuge. And we can run to so many things, and they will actually become hard to escape and prove to be no escape at all. God is our escape. He is our refuge, our hiding place, a strong fortress, a mighty tower. God is our refuge and strength, a helper who is always found in times of trouble. My escape experientially and not just intellectually must be God. Your escape experientially and intellectually must be God. So while I say these words, and I want for your mind to comprehend them and to believe them, that yes, God is my refuge. He is where I go to escape. I want you to live in that. To experience that. You know, John 5, I reference all the time. Jesus is talking to some people who know the scriptures. They know the Torah. They could quote almost the entirety of it, if not all of it. And he says, you search the scriptures, for in them you think you find eternal life. And rightly so, but you fail to see they point to me. It is possible for us to know the entirety of the scriptures, to know it, to give cognitive assent to it, to comprehend, and yet to not actually live in that, to experience and encounter God. I want to give you a moment to do that, to hear God saying, the invitation is real. God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in times of trouble. He is the escape. What do you want to escape? What is tempting you to run to whatever your drug of choice is? Bring it to mind right now. What is your escape? This is not your classic beat fathers up on Father's Day sermon. But let's be honest, men. I think for a lot of us, our escape is work. It's easier to thrive at work than it is at home. Do you throw yourself into work to escape? Is it porn? Is it Netflix? Hulu? Is it a video game? Is it countless hours of sports? Is it shopping? You know what it is. Be honest about it right now. And now I want you to turn to Jesus. And if you need to do this in your seat, I want you to open your hand. turn to Jesus and open your hand. Whatever you are holding on to that is not him, whatever your escape is, open your hand and turn to Jesus with it. If you can come to an honest place with your Lord to admit what it is, now I want you to ask him, what is actually the greater pain or sin behind or below what you thought you were trying to escape? What is truly at the heart of what you're trying to escape that makes you run here? Turn to Jesus. Embrace him. God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in times of trouble. Embrace him, knowing that he has never let go of you. You are in his sovereign hand, and nothing and no one can separate you from him. See him, your refuge, your strength, your escape, and hear him lovingly say, come to me, all who are weary and heavy laden, and I will give you rest for your soul.